I've been working, I'm a professor of clinical psychology, and I do think that when we take something out of religion and spirituality and put it into clinical psychology, something will happen. And we are not very sure about what will happen. But I will try to give you some examples that meditation, spirituality, do something. Because it's going to be a tool, a treatment tool. And what can we do with a treatment tool? We can evaluate it. We can ask people to fill out questionnaires and ask them to count if they are much help. And we can make a scale where they have to select between 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 points of being helped. Well, I've been doing this to traveling around in Tibet, North Asia, with a questionnaire of mindfulness. Have you heard about mindfulness?
Yeah.
Too much. But a psychologist, Ruth Baer, made a questionnaire about mindfulness, and he translated that into Tibetan language and gave it to a lot of, actually 70 Tibetan meditators to see how would they think about our way of thinking meditation. And of course they think it in a very different way than we do. First of all, they do not have different position of the ego, they only have one, and they have been working with that for many generations. So the way we are talking about meditation as a reflective position is very strange for them. That, for example, after I've been meditating for many years, I'm more attentive when I'm not attentive. After I've been meditating for many years, I'm more aware when I'm not aware. And that you have the answer you have to grade in 5 points. But it's a very difficult question. And so we asked the Tibetan people what to think about. I have been working out there for 8 years, a couple of months every year, and I've been working with a Tibetan Lama. We have been traveling around and filming people in the caves, hermits, people in the monasteries, and we have searched a lot of the spiritual masters that we have done for many years. And actually, you are the one, the very first one who are going to see some of the footage of the film.
Just
so you can see we have been out there, traveling around in mountains and in caves. And I have to tell you that I'm not a Buddhist, but that position gives you much more power to ask strange questions. And the first guy who came where I went to be living for many years, Kama Lumpo is the person I've been traveling around with, and now we are meeting a head nun, and there you have the questionnaire translated into Tibetan.
It's almost like I'm doing some work without paying enough attention, but somehow I know that I'm not paying enough attention. which means you're actually paying attention to that which is not paying attention. You understand? So either it becomes very, very silly or it becomes extremely profound. One of these two. So the level of your tonami, I check, and tonami, how did I put off?
That's
number 15. Now, he says, if you don't pay attention to what you're doing, how would you know that? You know, because you're not paying attention at the first place. I think the most difficult is, I think in the West, people want to get enlightened too fast. And that is really contrary to what you told me, Peter, about in the West. The whole idea is to relax, isn't it? Relax. Because the very purpose of wishing to become Buddha in Mahayana tradition, for example, since Tibetan Buddhism is Mahayana and Vajrayana, I speak from that point of view, the very purpose, the very end of why you want to become Buddha is so that you can help everybody, which means after you become Buddha, you will have no time to rest, no time to relax, no holiday, nothing. So we must think twice before we want to get enlightened. Yeah. Because then you will not get time to relax. You understand? Another thing is in the West, people take things too seriously. People take things too seriously. So because of that, you become tensed, you know. There's an example that how tense or how loose should be your meditation. It's mentioned by, I think, Sarah Harper, the great Indian mass sitter. When you spin the cotton, you know, make thread, if your spinning is too tight, it will break. Understand? There will be a crisis. If the spinning is too loose, too lousy, then it won't be strong enough. Likewise, one's meditation should be. It should be neither tight nor loose. Just like the string of the guitar. When the string of the guitar is neither too tight nor too loose, then you get the best sound, isn't it? I often saw in Tibetan
So this was an emphasis. So you can see in our medical world, in our clinical psychology, we very often talk about meditation as a stress reduction. But the Tibetan people talk more like a spiritual compassion. And now I will just go through very quickly how we look at meditation as a tool in clinical psychology. And there I will talk about my investigation about 106 Tibetan torture survivors and their lamas, which we have been interviewing for many years. And then give examples about how the Tibetan questioning Western assessment method or the Western way of thinking meditation. And then I will give you one or two more people examples. Good luck. If you take the words awareness of the present experience, the acceptance, and put them together in different orders, you will see that in clinical psychology, meditation is very often named. It started with Freud, Oceana Phoenix, Jung, of course, Winnicott, Epstein, etc. So there's a long tradition within clinical psychology of talking about meditation, but very little about spirituality. discussion about meditation. Two French psychoanalysts, Miguel and Salomé, say you had to be somebody before you become nobody, meaning that you have to be psychoanalyst before you go into meditation. So you have to be into therapy before you go into this very dangerous situation of emptiness and numbness. Epstein, Engler discussed with them and said, but meditation is anything, you have to be much more qualified when you talk about meditation. And of course, Kernberg came in the discussion and talked about meditation with pathologies. So there was a very interesting discussion within clinical psychology in the 80s, but very little about spirituality. So here you, and I read that discussion many times, you can see that they are all very curious about meditation as a treatment tool, but very few talk about the spirituality of meditation. And what the result was, some talk about that meditation is multifaceted, supportive, explorative, and there's a combination of different kinds of self. But again, they divided meditation in different parts without talking about spirituality. And to tell you that I've fallen on a horse for a month ago, so therefore I'm shaking up my arm. And then come cognitive therapy, now we are in the end of the 90s in the scene, and they came in two very important parts of clinical psychology. One of them is the ruminative mind, saying that a lot of what we see as pathologies are because of the mind is ruminating. And Kurt Seema made a response style questionnaire and saw that especially people who were depressive, their main problem was the ruminating mind. Not the depressive mind, but the ruminating. And if you read Segal, Mark Williams, he said the first profound trial of mindfulness in their book, Mindfulness Based Cognitive Therapy for Depression, you will see again that it is ruminating, which they focus on. And then came Ruth Baer, saying another very important thing for clinical psychology, namely that self-awareness is not always a solution to pathology. Meaning, the more you have been in psychotherapy, the more aware you are of yourself. But that may in itself create problems, because you can be, if you are so much outside the patient, too much occupied on your body. Too much occupied on your mental life. So therefore you have to have a special position of your self-perception. So that she introduced the decentered awareness on the self or on the self-centered cognition. And Robert, I've met her several times, when I say, but mindfulness do have spiritual part, what do you think about that? That we call metacognition. And that's all. Metacognition, and then it is, in a way, allocated to the cognitive therapy and not to the spiritual thing. And there you see the very typical mindfulness program, acceptance, and always saying that it is inspired by Buddhist psychology. But different psychologists, among others, is John Donne, have said that this is not something coming from Buddhist tradition. It is something coming from the Western part of the world. And even some are saying, well, that can be translated into this and that kind of Tibetan language. John Donne said, no. What we do in Tibet is very different from what we do in the West. So there are among Tibetologists a great discussion just for a moment about years ago in New York Times, the Dirty Movie Lookers. It is a group of people who are making a censorship of film, and they're looking at the television, because they have to censor on film, and they're looking at the perversion of the great attention. And I think that the clinical psychologists are looking at spirituality.
It's the same.
So we can call us the Dirty Movie Lookers. But that Dirty Movie Lookers, they got problems for many reasons in the National Psychological Association in 2003. There was some work group who gave top priority to spirituality. Then they have been saying that it works for some person. Depression, it works for the third backbone of the depression. Depression is different. And same it is with many other studies. There's a lot of studies, but very few of them is evidence-based. And it is inspired from Buddhism. Very few talking about meditation do make a concrete reference Buddhist text, that do it just more like a mantra. This is inspired by Buddhism. Yeah, of course, mindfulness is constructed in circular way. Somebody has called it a pizza. Have you heard about the pizza? What's the name? There are some Italian immigrants in New York in the 80s. The 1880s, they were very poor, and they invented the pizza because they were very poor and very hungry. They took some bay and some tomato and oregano, and that they called the pizza. So when the first American tourist came to Italy in the 20s, there was of course for pizza, but they didn't know what pizza was. So they had to write to the immigrants in New York about how was the receipt of pizza. In a way, that circular construction is the same for Buddhism. So Buddhism is a way, in the West, is a kind of pizza. And the Tibetan people like that pizza because it gives a lot of support in the Western world for the Buddhist way. So the pizza effect. I hope you understand that what I'm saying is that meditation is more than just the two. And that, of course, they could not accept it as a tool. I made two words apart from the word. And I could tell you very shortly that me and the Israeli government, we interviewed about 100 torture survivors and also their therapists. All Westerners and even the Tibetans for themselves have claimed that symptoms are rare among Tibetan survivors. Because of Buddhism, we do not have many symptoms of torture. That is not correct, of course not. All studies show that the Tibetan people do indeed show distress, but they do it in another way than many other people. So, of course, they have distress and illness. Buddhism give it another form. Our main distress consists in not having focused mind expressed in terms of despair and suffering without meaning. Many of the torture survivors said, our problem is that we don't have a sharp mind anymore. They're not really talking about depression or anxiety, but about cognitive then all talk about Buddhism and Dalai, not that it's held, but to have Buddhism and His Holiness Dalai in our mind was important for us. And I know this very sad because I've gone through 100 answers, written answers, and nobody talked about that it held, and it was a good coping or surviving mechanism. They just say to be into Buddhism and to have His Holiness Dalai to say. So they will not consider Buddhism and Dalai Lama as a tool. It's much more than that. And then I asked them about what we were doing in our Western psychology up there. And they say, this questionnaire. You know, we are very shy people, we don't like to talk about ourselves. You only ask about our problems and symptoms. The categories in your questionnaire are too simple. Anxiety and depression is much more than what you think it is. And they also said to me, I've been joining the Solinus Dalai Lama Mind and Life conferences. And there was one a Buddhist monk coming to a psychiatrist there saying, how do you define health? Because you're talking about schizophrenia and depression, but how do you define health? And the psychiatrist was thinking and said, yeah, it's difficult for us because we don't have too much empirical data. So, yeah, we get the data for defining health. Our main problems are problems of concentration and difficulty with having the focus on. How do you Western people graduate your feelings? How to do that? And then I will answer in a way so other people don't feel that they are different from me. So I've said all my marks in the middle. I hope you can understand that what I'm telling you in my broken English, sorry for that, is that when you introduce our clinical psychology to Tibetan people who are expert in meditation, they don't always find it meaningful. And we have to be very critical about how we evaluate.
One or two more?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Yes. First, I will take Mathieu Ricard, the son of you know, this monk living for many years in Tibet, in Malaya. He was a very famous scientist in Paris, but took one journey to Tibet and never came back. And he's living there for many, many years. And he once came back because his father was a very famous philosopher, political philosopher. And when he arrived back to Paris, they make an interview together. Actually, they stayed with his father and him together for a couple of days. And that, the result of that is the monk and the philosopher.
Great.
A great. And thereafter, I will let you meet Tenzin Palmo. She has been living 20 years in a cave and only meditating there. 20 years in a cave and doing meditation. That's something about attachment. It will take about 7 minutes. Good luck.
Yeah, so mindfulness is just a tool, just to be purely mindful in itself there's no reason that it should be wholesome unless it includes an ethical component of being mindful of the desirable or undesirable consequences of the mental state, how much suffering or happiness it might bring. Give the example of the sniper, who could have a perfect definition of mindfulness, someone who is very lucid, whose mind is neither falling into torpor nor into distraction, that any moment that is distracted, it brings back right away to the target, who is not disturbed by emotional disturbances because that will prevent him from being accurate, but simply is about to kill someone. So that shows that in our interpretation, mindfulness without any ethical component is just a tool.
But how to be alone for so long time?
Well, I think if you're friends with yourself, then you don't have to feel lonely. Most people feel lonely because they are not their own best friend. And in addition, if you realize you're surrounded by all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of the universe, then it actually gets quite crowded.
One of the first things you said when you went out of retreat was that you were never bored.
Yes, well, this is true, but this is because I had a lot of practices to do. Mm-hmm. And so that took up much of the day and night. And also, when you look at your mind, I mean, on the one hand, your mind is very boring. But on the other hand, it also can be quite entertaining.
But in the Western psychology, people are very much involved in relationships to other people, and the problem of life is about relationships to other people.
Well, the problem is that most people don't know how to relate to themselves. And once they learn how to relate properly with themselves, then it's very easy to relate to other people. In the meantime, if we think that all our happiness depends on something outside of ourselves, the other, then we're more likely to be very disappointed, isn't it?
Didn't you have a moment where you were depressed?
Oh, so everybody goes up and down in the ocean of samsara. But when you're in a state of pure awareness, there's no depression.
But from the in the Abhidhamma,
mm-hmm.
The name of depression is never named.
Well, you know, the thing is that our ordinary, as long as we identify with this sense of me and mine, which is a solid, enduring, separate quality within us, which separates me from everybody else who is non-me, then we are endlessly trying to satisfy this sense of me. But it's like a black hole. It never can be satisfied. And the more we focus our attention on trying to bring enduring happiness and security to something which by its own nature doesn't really exist in the way that we conceive of it to exist, then we're going to be disappointed. And so of course we get depressed.
Thank you so much.
Well, nice to meet you. And good luck with your project.
I hope you understand. My message is that when we take meditation, spirituality into our clinical work, something will happen. And it might be very dangerous, and people might even laugh at us. As you saw. But I agree that it might be possible to do it. Then we should be very aware of the ethical dimension.